Hello, and welcome to episode 157 with a Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Dr. Dan Durand, Chairman of Radiology at LifeBridge Health, Director and Operational Director at LifeBridge Health's Accountable Care Organization, or ACO, an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University Medicine, the former Vice President of Clinical Transformation at Evolent Health, and Dr. Durand is also the author of 80 peer-reviewed biomedical science papers. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
Thank you, Jordan. It's great to be joining you. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Excellent. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
That's an excellent question. So I think most healthcare providers, you know, think that in the daily course of their life, they're practicing an art that helps the public interest. And so from the portion of my career that I've been sitting in a chair or standing next to an examining table as a radiologist, hopefully that's been in the best interest of my patients as well. But outside of the clinical domain, along the organizational domain and the policy domains, there's been a couple of other areas that I've been lucky enough to get involved in, and you've mentioned some of them up front, so I'll talk about some of the organizations you already referenced. Earlier in my career when I was at Hopkins, a lot of the work that I did around safety, radiation safety, and also error prevention amongst radiologists and other healthcare providers, I think I view that as very important for the public's good. A lot of times when folks get sick and they're brought to the hospital, they don't have a lot of choice in the matter in terms of where they're going, and they have a fiduciary agreement in general with all hospitals, I would say, kind of a public trust in a way with the medical field that wherever they go, they'll get quality that's at a certain level. And some of that can be handled through regulations, but a lot of it can't. A lot of it relies on the practitioners to understand how to study their own quality and understand how to study their own safety and gradually improve it. And really over the last several decades has been just a revolution in the degree of understanding that doctors have about the impact of what they do and the amount of rigor and evidence that's applied to it. And so when I was at Hopkins, I got to stand on the shoulders of giants like people like Peter Pronovost and other folks that really began the quality of movement in the 90s and 2000s. And I was one of many people, you know, certainly not the only person, applying that to the field of radiology specifically. And the net outcome of all that and the many papers and the many years spent doing that was something that I call imaging stewardship. So if there's anything that I might be responsible or viewed as responsible for within radiology, it's the idea that we are stewards of a resource for the public. And part of what we're stewarding over is the quality, partly what we're looking at is making sure that the public isn't overcharged and that they don't incur too much healthcare costs. Part of it is the experience of care. And for radiology, uniquely amongst many medical specialties, another thing we need to think about is the amount of radiation that we impose on the public, because many radiology scans, including ones that you need, do have some radiation associated with them. So really the practice and the study of this field of imaging stewardship is something I spent a lot of time on in my career, and I think of that as really something that's very much in the public's best interest.
So on the topic of over-radiation, radiation applies to a wide spectrum across the electromagnetic spectrum. And so as I walk about in the streets, I'm exposed to radiation from the sun and other stars. I'm exposed to radiation from cell phones and television signals. What is it is that dangerous, or what is more dangerous about being exposed to radiation within a healthcare setting? Because if that's just a part of life, many listeners may wonder, well, what is the danger of being overly radiated?
That's a really good question. So you're absolutely right that the light that you see is a form of radiation, is a form of electromagnetic radiation. And as long as there have been people, and well before there were people, you know, really regardless of what philosophy or religion you ascribe to, at some point there weren't people, but there would have been electromagnetic radiation at that point. So it's always been around, and so why should we obsess about it now? And the answer is you shouldn't obsess about it, that type of radiation really is safe. Within radiology, we're forced to use slightly higher powered radiation, a little more energy in it, and it's called ionizing radiation. And it's the production of those small ions, which is, again, a physical term. I don't want to burden this this podcast with a bunch of technical jargon, but that ionizing radiation is not something you see everywhere. It's really something you see just in certain contexts. And in fact, if you look at the total exposure of the U.S. population to that ionizing radiation, which is the type that is known to cause cancer, more than half of that comes from radiology, from diagnostic imaging. If you went back 30 or 40 years, that wouldn't be the case. There's the so-called background radiation, very low level that we're all exposed to from the stars in the cosmos and some of the uranium in the ground, as you referenced, and some of the radon, people know about that. But really, most ionizing radiation that the public is exposed to these days comes from diagnostic imaging. And that can be perfectly fine if each and every instance of exposure, the patient's benefit is outweighing their risk. And that's the goal of stewardship within imaging stewardship, and that's to make sure that while it's an unavoidable downside of imaging, that the upside for the patient always exceeds the small increase in lifetime cancer risk that comes with each and every X-ray or CT scan.
So can we just define for our listeners who didn't do so well, or perhaps as well as you in high school physics, what exactly is the study of radiology? Why would ionizing radiation be useful? How is it in terms of creating images and tests? Can you just elaborate upon why anybody would actually want to have a test test done on them that might expose them to increased risk for down the line actually getting cancer?
Exactly. So it really is the regular light that travels around, you know, in your house from a light bulb or even outside the sunlight. Clearly, you can't see through skin. You can't see through a person, see their bones with that light. I mean, that's just a fact of life, right? If that light had more energy in it, it would allow you to sort of penetrate some of those tissues and you'd be able to see some of these structures. There are lots of different ways of doing medical imaging. There are some ways...
Just to interject there, so it's a fault of the energy of the radiation that prevents us from seeing each other's bones through our skin, or is it a fault of our eye?
I don't know that anybody's at fault, but yeah, if you had, it's not really a fault of the eye, though. I mean, even if the most sensitive detector, for example, of regular light, you know, it doesn't allow you to use regular light to see through a human body or a bunch of skin. Okay.
So an X-ray is just a different type of electromagnetic radiation than that which is visible in the light spectrum. So instead of seeing blue, you see X-ray.
Exactly. It's a higher energy form of a light wave, a photon. Exactly. There are many types of radiation, but that's the most common one that's used. Is the one.
So,
yep. And not
so,
all. One thing I want to be really important with, since there are people in the public listening to the call, hopefully, is that, not all radiology tests involve ionizing radiation. So ultrasound and none, right? Ultrasound, it uses sound waves, the same way that a dolphin or a bat detects things using sound waves. That's basically what the computer in an ultrasound machine is doing. No.
And is that dangerous?
Not at all. And then there is something called MRI, which people are familiar with, and that is primarily a different type of radiation that's more like a cell phone frequency radiation, and it's not ionizing. So there's zero ionizing radiation from either MRI or ultrasound. As a pediatric radiologist, which is what I'm dual boarded in adult and pediatric, when I'm doing pediatric radiology, I do everything possible to make sure we use the lowest dose or zero dose scan. So we use a lot of more MRI and ultrasound in those populations.
Interesting. So
yeah, X-ray.
How...
CT scans, sorry, Jordan, are the ones that have the ionizing radiation.
So X-rays, yeah, and CT scans. So since you are so involved in quality and patient safety, I'm interested in, I guess, how a physician, particularly a radiologist, might judge the costs and benefits of providing an ionizing radiation-emitting diagnostic test for a patient versus when, of course, such a test could have long-term accumulated negative externalities. How do you actually judge the costs and benefits of doing a test? And then can you relate that to what you referenced earlier, which is overuse of imaging, diagnostic imaging in American medicine?
Absolutely. So in a given encounter in an emergency room, for example, the actual risk to an individual patient, let's say of a CT scan of the stomach, of the abdomen, somebody dealing with abdominal pain, and the question is whether or not that pain is severe enough to warrant a CT scan. The lifetime risk of ever having an issue, even 20 years from now, with cancer based on that scan is way below 1%. It's probably below 0.1%. Now, that patient wouldn't be in the emergency room if they felt like they didn't have more than 1% chance of having serious issues or even dying in the next 24 hours. So in the moments around an individual patient, the answer is more frequently than not that they need the scan. So, but the question is, how do we do the scan at the lowest dose possible? So sometimes you might take two separate pictures of the body in order to get some information, but really that doubles the dose. So if you can get by doing the one picture or taking a picture, a smaller picture, all of these things, right, can decrease the overall negative impact, and you're still getting most of the information. And that's kind of the art of radiology in general and the art of imaging stewardship. The reason that somebody like me has a job, you know, I'm not doing the surgeries, I'm not doing the upfront intake of the patient and establishing a face-to-face relationship with them. But what the value that I bring to the patients, the public, and the physicians is how do you optimize this resource, get the best information possible, and minimize the risks of radiation and other things as well that are a consequence of us using the imaging technology. So that being said, it's all about systems, right? It's all about knowing the data that says, okay, when do we really need to do the scan? It's about knowing what the risks are in a really quantitative way and studying all the patients who have ever gotten a CT scan and looking at their records to see how many CT scans it takes, for example, to have a small but real incremental increase in your cancer risk. So it's all these systems-based approaches, both to understanding the risks and then also shaping the way that we care for patients. That's the art of stewardship, and that's the form it takes. On any given case, you know, it's very hard on any given case to specifically give an exact probability, right? This particular patient with this scan, you know, this is the number that describes your risk, and this is the number that describes the chance that the scan will save your life. That's not really the form the data takes. It's more like if we treat these patients with these types of symptoms, do we need the scan or not? And then if yes, you know, how can we optimize the radiation dose within that scan?
So are scans generally supposed to lead to decision to either taking action or not taking action?
We would like them to, yeah. We tell our ordering physicians, the general physicians that the patients see, when those guys are ordering a test for you, they should never be doing it unless they know how the result of that test will impact your treatment. So never just to look, and that goes for anything. That goes for a blood test as well. That's how you incur a lot of extra cost.
And so, because it may be nice to know, like, oh, this or that is true about me, but regardless of whether it's true or false, I will decide to not do any action. There's no action I could take. Therefore, it's probably better to not do the test because having that knowledge won't change the course of treatment.
And sometimes it can lead to anxiety. So here's a good example. If I had a test today, in the absence of any really great treatment for Alzheimer's, if I have a test that could tell you today whether or not you're going to get Alzheimer's at some point in your life, right? Would you want to know? I mean, this is the Pandora's box of a lot of genetic testing, and we're really at the beginning of this era. And society, I think there's no right answer to this, although there are definite benefits and drawbacks, right? So the benefits are the pre-knowledge, which frankly may or may not be a benefit because it can lead to a lot of anxiety about something you can't change, but some people would I want to know, right? I want to know. That's my right to know. If it's knowable and it concerns me and my health, I have a right to know. And that's a very real opinion, you know, and it's a very personal opinion. But the drawback around the anxiety that creates is one drawback, right? And then the drawback of, well, if we pay for everybody in society to have this test, let's say we have this theoretical test that can tell you whether or not you're going to develop Alzheimer's, well, we're going to pay for the entire society to have that test and know, create a lot of anxiety that we can't treat amongst people who are positive for the test, perhaps create some beneficial peace of mind for those who are negative for the test. But at the end of the day, we would have spent a lot of money testing people, right? And that's money that wouldn't go to people without health insurance and a variety of other things, right? So these are the kind of decisions that policymakers, thankfully not doctors, have to make. But just having information, even if it is their information, even if the information is right, doesn't always translate into something meaningful for a patient or a
human being. Dan, you talk about price and cost, and I want to bring this conversation back towards your role at LifeBridge working on the ACO, which for our listeners, again, is an accountable care organization. Now, before we get there, I'll just add that it seems as though diagnostic imaging with ionizing radiation could have two primary negative externalities. One, it can over-radiate you, which could lead to some sometimes small, sometimes insignificant, sometimes significant chance of getting cancer down the line. And two, it costs money to do that, and it costs money to society and the whole health system, as you just alluded to. Now, you work for this ACO, which is an outgrowth of the Affordable Care Act, which essentially deals with cost shifting from a fee-for-service incentive-based system that incentivized more volume and more tests, regardless of clinical value to patient outcomes, now to something where you're trying to reduce imaging while improving outcomes. I'd like to ask you, Dan, to speak about this transition from fee-for-service to value-based payments within the ACO model and how that's affecting radiology imaging particularly, and whether this is improving imaging stewardship.
Yeah, well, I think the answer, the simplest answer to give to the variety of questions is yes. There's no question that payment reform in general is focusing radiologists and making it more rewarding for us to spend our time doing stewardship actions. In the past, those actions were uncompensated and might even hurt your bottom line, so it was a hard, really spending a lot of time doing them was sometimes a hard sell to one's boss or elsewhere in the organization because they felt like they were funding this and there wasn't a mandate to fund that kind of work. Payment reform from CMS, but also from the private sector, has been really the shift that you mentioned from volume to value. I think, particularly this time in our country's history, one of the wonderful things about this shift is that it is really a bipartisan shift. There are differences on how this should be done. You mentioned that this particular program, the ACO program, is contained within the Affordable Care Act. That is true. But I would venture to say, and this is just Dan's opinion here, that it's also true that if the ACA or Obamacare were to be replaced by something, I don't think you would see the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services throw the ACO program out. I'd be very surprised to see that. Now, what is the ACO program or what are ACOs? I think it's a very good question that listeners might have. And I'll just talk about the Medicare Shared Savings Program briefly without getting too detailed and technical. The Medicare Shared Savings Program basically says to a group of healthcare providers, let's work together on healthcare value for patients who get Medicare. And what that means is let's make sure that they get the best possible quality. And that really is 90% of what you spend your time on in an ACO thinking about. And then if in doing that, in improving the quality, you can also contain the cost. So if you can find innovative ways of helping patients out that make them healthier and also save the U.S. taxpayers money, that you can get some percentage of that back, again, depending on how well you did it, to help fund your efforts. It's one of many programs within Medicare and one of many programs nationally that has that general feel to it. And so Medicare essentially keeps track of the quality through the information that you report to them, and they also keep track of the cost that they pay out. And at the end of the year, depending on how you do, they may or may not share some of that that cost savings with you to help fund future transformation efforts within your health system.
So, Dan, we've spoken a great deal about your role as a radiologist, your work with ACOs, and how ACOs are really transforming the way medical care is delivered or are indicative of changes across society. I'd like to shift to transformations in your own life and innovations in your own life. You have a history as of entrepreneurship. You've been involved in various tech startups, particularly with regards to health. Could you speak for a moment about some of your activities within the world of entrepreneurship and why you've gotten involved in those endeavors?
Sure. Early on in my career at Hopkins, I really jumped off the typical academic track and decided that I wanted to experience and see what went on in the non-academic sector and in the private sector, and also a little bit of the government sector, to see how people went from idea to reality in those different places. In academia, going from idea to reality means studying something very thoroughly, which is good, but it often means things like grant writing, you know, asking people for free money to study something, and then once you prove it, it struck me that the implementation of those things, whether it's a device or an invention or a new way of treating people, is often unclear and is, in fact, very frequently executed by the private sector. And because I wanted to be kind of a change agent, I felt that I need to get out there and see that. So I went and I managed to get a job for McKinsey & Company and spent about a year working with them. And then a variety of folks left places like McKinsey and the advisory board company to form a company called Evolent Health, which was already in existence at that time, and I joined as part of the second wave of leaders that helped form that company. And the goal at Evolent, and which continues these days, it's gone public and it's a publicly traded company, is to partner with the best and brightest and biggest health systems and help them think about this transition from volume to value and how to get there. But to go back to the personal level, you know, that was why I did that. I felt that there are many good things about medical training and the early faculty development pathway that professors get at medical schools, but I felt there was also a bit of a rigidity to it, and it felt very ivory tower at times. It felt very separate from the rest of the world and the rest of the way that most physicians were practicing medicine, and I wanted things to move a little bit faster and to learn how to be nimble and how to take an idea quickly from concept to reality in the real world, not just in a journal.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So have you seen, I guess you wanted to be a change agent and move ideas into reality. Could you give an example of an idea that you've helped move into reality that helps you be a change agent in the world of entrepreneurship?
Sure, yeah. So I think entrepreneurship is a mechanism of expediting some of these changes, right? So you may have an idea in academia and write about it, and locally people think it's a great idea, and it may become part of how, if you're a doctor, for example, in a medical school, it might be part of how that medical school cares for patients. But if you can't figure out a way to make a very strong business case for something and explain to others why it's in their best interest to do it, then it becomes very hard to get buy-in and see your innovation take hold and scale out. You know, you have to, in entrepreneurship, I think it's a bit like being a doctor, but a bit different, right? So one of the entrepreneurs I've worked very closely with and respect very deeply is a man named Mike Mardini, who's had three separate companies that he's built within radiology IT. And he told me, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur, the secret to it is to solve somebody's problem. If you solve somebody's problem with a sticky solution, everybody's going to want it. You know, that's why Google got big, right? That's why most companies, if you think about them, it's very obvious that they solve somebody's everyday basic problem. And even niche companies that are smaller but very successful, they might solve a fewer number of people's problem, but they're solving it very well and very consistently, and that's why they're growing, right?
Mm-hmm.
you look at from that mindset, if you look at a lot of work that gets done in academia, it's not always pitched in that way, right? It's maybe more about a search for truth or understanding something deeper. But that's different than sort of why the average person or the average practitioner in healthcare should care about that and change their practice. So I'll give you an example. One of the biggest things that negatively impacts the practice of medicine in general, and it interestingly hasn't been much a part of the dialogue with either the Obama reform or the coming Trump reform, is the idea of malpractice liability, right? So everybody agrees that doctors should be accountable for their mistakes. Nobody disagrees with that. But the way we handle it in this country is, I would argue, very, very messy, because many of the times that there's damages awarded, there really wasn't much of a mistake that was made by the doctor. And many times there are mistakes made by doctors and damages aren't awarded. And part of that has to do with how the information around what happened gets looked at. It gets looked at in a very biased way. You essentially have expert witness paid for one side and an expert witness paid for by another side, and they kind of argue and often cancel each other out, which sort of leaves the jury on its own. And so within the field of radiology, when in the academic part of my life, I wrote a lot of papers and studied the idea of what they call observer bias. And that's to say, listen, if you really wanted to know if a radiologist made a mistake when they read a chest x-ray, great way to know that is you're asking what the standard of care is. Well, the neat thing about radiology is you could have 1,000 people read that chest x-ray. So if you could get them to do it, and if you could really mimic the context in which they read it, you could understand, listen, this is a chest x-ray that is missed. You know, this is a chest x-ray finding that is so subtle that 95% of all radiologists will miss it. How are you going to string this guy up in court and sue him for missing what almost anyone will miss, right? That's the point of it. And everybody agreed and sort of clapped when I was an academic, you know, great idea, you know, because I had sort of built the statistics for this and shown how it could be done. But nobody did it, right? And no lawyers were using this in the real world. No radiologists were benefiting from it. And it's about 8 years later now, right? And while it's after I left the full-time academic track, one of the things I did with my time from an entrepreneurial standpoint is helped an individual on the West Coast build an IT company that allows for what I just said. So allows for images to be viewed by multiple different radiologists at different sites, allows them to be paid a little bit for doing that, but an honest amount, not an exorbitant amount, and appropriately blinds them. So, for example, they don't know if they're working for the prosecution or the plaintiff or the defense, right? They don't know. They don't know what the outcome is. They don't know if it's a positive or negative control. And they look at many images, and they give an honest assessment, and the system tests them, right, on how good they are as they're reading through the non-index, the non-cases of interest, and on the case of interest, you can say at the end of that study what I said before, which is okay. This lesion, this thing that became a cancer that the radiologist initially didn't see, that was a big deal because 90% of people saw that, so he should have seen that, versus the opposite result, which is this thing that people are saying he should have seen, almost nobody would have said anything about that at that point in time. Only 5% of people even mentioned it. So that
Dan, that sounds like an incredible example of how you're able to put theory into practice and really bring science into the courtroom. However, we are approaching the end of this podcast, and so I'd like to ask you a final question, if you wouldn't mind, which is to reflect upon your career in medicine, your experience in entrepreneurship, and your time in radiology, and I'd like you to take a moment and speak to our listeners about why it is you found all of this worthwhile, how you see yourself advancing the public interest, and what the end of your career you hope your legacy will be in terms of responsible. You mentioned that you hope to bring imaging stewardship to the forefront and that might be a legacy. So can you take a moment to speak about why you've been interested in helping others and what the legacy is, what will be the effects of your time in healthcare?
Sure. Well, my career has been pretty circuitous, and I think of myself as early to middle career, so it's very speculative for me to think about where this ultimately lands. What what I find meaningful about it, what drew me to medicine is I've always been kind of a cerebral, intellectual person. You know, I like abstract thought, and I like the sciences, but I also care about people. So medicine is an area, is a type of field where you get to do both. The smarter you get, the better it is for folks, I think, theoretically. But I noticed that our healthcare system, I think everybody notices at this point, particularly as it existed 10 years ago, despite all the different stakeholders meaning having really the best intentions between the drug companies trying to come up with cures and the hospitals trying to have sustainable operations and the physicians trying to do good for their patients, but the economics of all of it created some real issues, both in terms of people not getting the care they need and then lots of people getting too much care sometimes and getting complications from it. So however I do it, you know, we've talked about a variety of different ways that I'm engaged in trying to improve the system, but the system that I ultimately want to see toward the end of my career, and I don't certainly won't just be me, but will have been a variety of people that helped us get there, is a system that more consistently delivers on behalf of the public when they're patients and when they aren't patients. So a healthcare system that feels more accessible, that gets all that great science and gets those outcomes for the patients, and is funded in a more rational way that has to do with what gets delivered, you know, rather than what gets done to a patient. So not just the amount of surgeries that are done, but really the amount of people that are still walking around on those artificial joints, for example. Things like that. How do we create a system that encourages innovation and that guarantees, in a way, that we'll get the highest quality care actually delivered, not just sold to someone, but delivered, so they get the benefits that they should expect being a citizen in, you know, the best country in the world.
So that has been Dr. Dan Duran, the Chairman of Radiology at LifeBridge Health, the Medical Director and Operational Director of LifeBridge Health ACO, an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins Medicine, former VP of Clinical Transformation at Evolent Health, and the author of 80 peer-reviewed biomedical science papers, who speaks about leaving a legacy that fundamentally delivers higher quality health care to Americans. He speaks about imaging stewardship, where he elaborates on the costs and benefits of offering ionizing radiation in the form of diagnostic imaging tests to really ensure that there are actionable, actionable decisions that physicians can take based on actual data and science, and the value of those actions in relation to the potential for that radiation to eventually potentially cause cancer down the line. Very many ethical issues. He speaks about physics and ethics, philosophy, bringing together the cerebral abstract thought that so appeals to him, while also grounding everything that he speaks about within the context of helping people, helping patients, and making society healthier, whether it's ensuring that we have the funds as a society to continue to afford healthcare through cost shifting and healthcare reform, or by bringing his interest in data-driven decision-making to entrepreneurship and taking a stab at helping reform the medical tort reform in the United States. These are all many challenges that Dr. Duran has accepted and delighted in being a part of, because for him, advancing the public interest means doing what you can to take care of real problems. He identifies myriad problems that are interconnected, and throughout his life, you can see a trend of Dan going about and trying to integrate these different problems in one solution, in multiple solutions, as he tries to make the world better for everyone. So, Dan, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jordan. It's a pleasure, and that was a fascinating recap. I think you said it. You said everything I said in 30 minutes and 3 minutes or less. That was great. Thank you.
So this has been episode 157 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We remind you to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com, listen on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And should you wish to communicate with Dan, you can call 240-630-0380. And